This is episode 14 with Damon D'Amore and Blake Morgan.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
Aloha and welcome to this episode of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. Excited that you're here today and excited for our two guests, Damon D'Amore and Blake Morgan. Blake is a leader in customer experience. She is a keynote speaker and author of two books, including The Customer of the Future, 10 Guiding Principles for Winning Tomorrow's Business. Blake is a guest lecturer at Columbia University and adjunct faculty at Rutgers Executive Education MBA program. Blake contributes to Forbes, the Harvard Business Review, and Hemispheres Magazine. She is the host of the Modern Customer Podcast and the Be Your Own Boss podcast. Damon is a C-suite performance specialist working with top CEOs, founders, executives, and creatives in North America. He has founded multiple startups, both raising millions in investment capital, and is an international speaker. Interestingly, Damon produced a number of creative brand integrations for Fortune 500 companies as a producer of the reality TV shows Undercover Boss and The Apprentice with Donald Trump. One of the things I really enjoyed about this episode was the fact that Damon produced the Undercover Boss TV show, and Blake admits that this is one of her favorite shows of all time. This guides the dialogue to focus on the value chain of leadership, from personal self-awareness to employee satisfaction, all the way to customer experience. In this dialogue, we discuss the power of listening, how positivity increases resilience, how to align tasks with goals, the importance of feelings in the customer experience, why good leaders are just normal people, why we need to slow down, how to balance feelings and facts, and the role of self-validation and external validation for future-focused leadership. Let's listen. Aloha, Blake and Damon. Thank you both for joining me today. As always, I want to start with this key question of, you know, how can leadership be more smart or intelligent about the future, given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in the world? And love for you both to answer this from your perspective of your work. And I'll start with Blake.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about what's happening in the world today is we're seeing this appreciation for introversion, where in the past, extroverts got all the attention. Business seemed to be about how loud you could speak and how much you could talk. And now we're seeing this twist where it's, well, actually, how much can you listen? How long can you wait before you speak and share your own opinion? And I think that while this seems really simple, it's truly a gift that now we understand that executives and businesses that spend more time listening than they do talking are much more informed, and they really build better businesses, because today there's so much noise, clearly. And I think some of the biggest businesses have really, really smart leaders. I wrote a book called The Customer of the Future. And in the book, I talk about customer-focused C-suite executives. And one of the things I've noticed in my research is that the executives that actually are founder CEOs that are willing to be misunderstood for long periods of time, they are more customer centric than other leaders. And I think that's a beautiful thing, because most CEOs, you know, you'd imagine a leader of a company, they come in to turn a profit, to stay for a few years, make the company money, make the stock price grow, and then move on to their next job. But founder CEOs like Elon Musk, or Jeff Bezos, they don't really care about being misunderstood for long periods of time. And they're more interested in the value they bring to their community and taking pride in what they're building. And so I know you asked about leadership, which is much broader than what I'm talking about. But again, it's back to this idea of kind of being an introvert, of being a listener, being slow to speak, really taking your time to understand something before making a decision about it.
That's great, Blake. Thank you for sharing that. And Damon, from your perspective, how do you answer this question?
Yeah, it's funny. Blake talked about listening, and I agree. And I'm a big fan of Greg McKeown, who wrote Essentialism. And one of his principles is that almost everything is noise when you really dial down to it. So I think a big part of the process is, you know, A, working on themselves as leaders, and in two respects. One, kind of that essentialist mindset in as to what do you focus on and why, and are you constantly checking to make sure you're focusing on what's important? But in order to make sure what is survivable and thrivable in the future, in the world of change, it's kind of a buzzword these days, but one of the three pillars I work on with executives is building resilience. And it's also, what is their individual definition of resilience? I personally define it as being an optimist, meaning you wake up every day knowing things are probably going to go horribly wrong, but but you're going to be okay because you're prepared for it. So, you know, I think that's a major component of getting ready for what's next, because if you create a system that is personalized for you in whatever it is, tactical, strategic, how you plan, how you execute, how you communicate to your team, if that process works over and over in different scenarios, as long as you know that you're going to be okay, whatever comes next at you next, you can adapt to that. So I would say focusing and prioritization is the first thing. And the second big thing is building a resilient mindset for yourself and your team. And also showing your team that it's okay to fail, you know, putting yourself out there as a leader so that they know that if they do fail, they're not going to get their heads knocked off.
Those are great points both of you make. And I think it's interesting. One is how they're related a lot. But two, I'm curious how you think with so much information and data that's out there now, how do we listen better?
I think it's about asking the right questions. So not being overwhelmed by information, but being really thoughtful about what are the questions you're trying to answer. And the word thoughtfulness is really important to me in my work, because I think there's a lack of thoughtfulness out in the world. And I like to hear Damon talk about resilience, and some of the other words that come to mind are mindfulness and self-development, that I think we need to be kind of quiet in our heads to understand, well, what's the problem we're solving and what is going to help us get there. And I think that so many people and companies are just moving so quickly through modern life is very busy. But what I love is when I meet people who, it's like they don't seem to be fazed by the chaos around them. They move slowly. They think even slowly and make decisions thoughtfully. And these are the leaders we need. I call them transformational leaders. Because I believe, and I always tell audiences when I give a speech, that we live in really complicated times and we really need thoughtful people thinking about tomorrow. Waking up in the morning, I like what Damon talked about, being positive, being resilient, knowing that, yes, there's no shortage of problems in the world, but we need extremely thoughtful, even slow leaders that are taking in all this information and thinking, well, what are the implications if I do A, you know, what are the implications of that over doing choice B? My husband's really into chess, and I mean, I don't play chess, but I do like this idea of like the chess master's mindset. It's, they're not thinking about just what's happening tomorrow. They're thinking, well, what are the long-term implications of a move? And so again, I'm always going to come back to this notion of thoughtfulness, mindfulness, moving slow. And you talked about data and information. I mean, it comes, no matter if it's data or information or whatever decision you're making, just being extremely thoughtful about the problems you're trying to solve every day and how you do that.
And Damon, in your work, are you seeing executives kind of overloaded or just with data and information? Is that an issue for them? How are they
handling? Yeah, their ability to curate that or have someone they trust curate it is really important, especially the higher up you go and the more people that want your attention and want to prioritize your time for you. Mm-hmm. Being able to set, whether it's by your value list, whether it's by your strategic goals, whether it's a quarterly goal that you need to knock out for your shareholders, whatever it might be, you need to have the discipline to say, there's 10 opportunities in front of me this quarter. 8 of them could be really, really good. But only 2 could be great that are on target with what I'm supposed to be focusing on. Mm-hmm. And you have to have the discipline to be okay to not have the home run in one of those 2, but you're focusing on the right stuff. I love that Blake used the term thoughtfulness, because I always tell people there's things that you can control and things you can't. Things are going to go wrong because of your mistakes, which is fine. But a lot of things are going to go wrong that you can't control. You couldn't control the virus coming out now and, you know, all the business supply chain things going on with that. But you can control your perception of events and your reaction to them. So the more thoughtful that you can become as a leader, to Blake's point, you, A, inspire confidence that the sky is not falling. And B, it's really easy for you to get back on track if you have them either listed out or memorized, your team knows what you're supposed to be working on. Then you can take those data points that Blake spoke about and use them to support a narrative. Because every day, whether it's yourself, your board, or your customers, you're telling a story. And every day you're presented with new data points. You just have to choose and curate from everything coming at you what is the most important relevant data to support the narrative that you're telling in order to be successful.
That's great. Yeah, it's really interesting the perspective that both you're sharing. I know it kind of reminds me of studying martial arts and how there's a lot of potential data that can come at you in a fight or a martial arts scenario, but you have to really move at your own pace, and you have to also prioritize what's like important in that moment, so you respond correctly. If you're really reactive or not trained properly, then you make the wrong decisions pretty quickly.
But you know, and also just to use that example, I trained Tony Blauer Spear System, PDR. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that as an artist. Mm-hmm. But one of the things is, you try to react based on your training, but also there's going to be natural impulses that overtake that, like your flinch response. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to flinch, no matter if you're Muhammad Ali or whoever, or yourself, how do you use that and weaponize it and use it to be safe? So same thing with a leader. If you know that by default, you keep going back to the same default reaction every time something happens, even though you're not happy with it, How do you turn that into some sort of, not superpower, but at least the ability to get back to zero, the ability to get back to sea level, and then make a rational, you know, step forward?
I like that point. That's a really, it's really interesting. How do you use your default actions to your advantage? Blake, for you, with your work, I know you're also looking at customers of the future. How is that influencing leadership in the future?
Well, the world has changed. Customer experience has now become part of normal jargon, I think, for every C-level leader today, where it's become a major mandate at many, many companies, which is really exciting, because it turns out in an era where many of our products and services have become commodities, where there's just too much of the same, the way we make people feel proves to be truly one of the only ways to stand out as a company. And so that has changed the way that executives talk. That has brought this new awareness to humility, to the CEO like Elon Musk, who sits in the factory among his engineers. And I mean, if you watch old interviews with him, I mean, he's so involved in the design and the engineering of all of his companies, but I'm talking about the Tesla specifically. And I think that's the modern leader, that it understands that the customer truly is empowered today, that customer experience is really one of the only ways to stand out. And then they talk the talk and walk the walk. They're willing to go into the factories, to meet with customers, to sit on the phone and actually hear customer feedback. And they focus much more on design of experience design, product design, than they do like going on being a pundit on TV and news channels. And I think that's the beauty of the modern leader. They understand that that knowledge is power, and getting that knowledge comes from being on the ground in the trenches, not sitting in your office and simply looking at reports all day.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of a different picture than we're used to of a leader who, you know, sits in his office and tells everybody what to do. And this is somebody, you're kind of painting a picture of somebody who's a little more engaged with their people, with their customers, with the whole process of their business. Damon, from your perspective, how is that what you're seeing with executives too?
Yeah, I was really fortunate back on my entertainment days that I produced the first two seasons of Undercover Boss. So that was the whole premise.
Oh my gosh.
That was the whole premise of the show. Yeah, I produced The Apprentice back in the day with, you know, our current president. But my job on Undercover Boss was to go out. I interviewed about 350 CEOs to be on the show for the first two seasons, and we chose maybe 30 of them. But the whole premise was America hates these guys and gals. It was 2008 and 2009. We were in a recession and we needed to humanize them. And the way that you did that is to show they are actual people and they care. But having these men and women that were making decisions based on the worst economic environment in, you know, 60 years, they're just crossing off line items. And then they go down to the floor of a plant where they're like in a delivery truck. And they realize, oh my God, you can't go from five drivers to three. You have to at least have four. Like getting in there and actually working on the business, it was incredible. And I'm still, you know, a lot of those folks became friends and business partners and everything else going forward and things I did after that. But yeah, I got to see that firsthand. And it's amazing watching a leader of a massive company who thinks that they know what's going on based on spreadsheets and reports, because they're never getting the real deal. People are always polishing stuff for them. And to be able to go in and see it firsthand, it's amazing and it's emotional. But yeah, that was the future. And that started, and we aired our first show in 2009. So it's been 11 years and everybody's trying to replicate that feeling or that experience. But yeah, the most successful folks that I know from a culture standpoint are the ones who are willing to go down on the floor or go out with their employees and actually experience their jobs firsthand.
Just so you know, Tyler, I paid Damon to say that to beautifully supplement the comment I just made. The story, I knew he had done that.
No, I just got a Venmo.
That's amazing. That show absolutely is exactly what I'm talking about. And yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I think I like shed a few tears watching those shows and like the employees and the stories. That was like, I don't know if that show's still on because unfortunately I cut my cable, but I love that show. It was so good.
they just shot another season, and I was talking to somebody that's going to be a new client, and she said, oh, my husband would love talking to you. I said, no, what does he do? He's the CEO of this other company, and he's going to be on the new season of Undercover Boss. And I was like, oh my God, they're still making these shows. You know, people love them. It's like Undercover Boss and Shark Tank is all you see on CNBC after Marcus closed for like 18 hours a day.
That is the essence of customer experience. Exactly. Those CEOs that go, they put on these horrible makeup and wigs, no offense. And and like the things they would find, like the best was when you would see like an employee doing something horrible, then the CEO would like have empathy and like try and help or try and train them. But sometimes the employees, I mean, you saw everything on there. Sometimes employees were just, they were just bad news bears and they'd have to fire them. Anyway, go watch the show, listeners. It's a great show. Good job, Damon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's interesting too. It reminds me also of a show I used to like watching was The Prophet. And that was really, I thought that really showed a lot of the human side too of business. I mean, a lot of what he dealt with, it looked like was really people and people problems.
I tried to get Marcus an Undercover Boss, but his company wasn't big enough. All the employees knew who he was.
Well, it's such an interesting example of like this idea of having the CEO go and actually have to do the work that he's telling people to do, and see what happens. But does it mean that businesses in the future should be smaller, or leaders should create smaller businesses, or I don't know, what are some of the implications of this?
I'll start. I don't know if it's realistic to say that businesses will or should be smaller, but I actually think that customer experience has really leveled the playing field for small businesses because they're actually much more agile. They're not weighted down by legacy. And I personally worked at a Fortune 100 company where we were so product-centric over being customer-centric. We had so much jargon that I'd sit in these meetings, and like if you were a customer sitting in on a meeting, you would have no idea what anyone was talking about because we had our own like language. Mm-hmm. And I think this idea of this, you know, being so out of touch, being so big and bloated, sitting on our legacy, you know, this, it's an old mentality, but well, this is how we've always done things. I mean, this is really the major hindering block for these huge companies that need to go through digital transformation, that need to pivot and change the way they do things, and they just can't. And then you've got these young upstarts like Spotify, Netflix, even Amazon isn't that old, 20 years old, 22 years old. I mean, they're able to move so beautifully and quickly and pivot, and they don't have these old cultures, and it's truly an advantage. So I think that being small and nimble is an advantage. I think for these big companies, it's not the end of the world. I mean, they're just having to relearn culture. I think before we got on, we were talking about mindset. So maybe Damon could talk about some of the things he's done with his clients. But I mean, these things like mindset and culture, I always tell people are like, it's like the biggest advantage in your arsenal that you could have if you have that mindset, but it's very rare.
Hmm. Yeah, Damon, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. You know, I think that, well, not necessarily smaller, but it's about prioritization, right? If these mm-hmm. leaders make time once a quarter or twice a year to do the work that Blake's talking about and let everybody know that it's a priority, there's always a trade-off. The reward that you're getting from whatever you think you're doing isn't really a valuable reward unless you're trading it for something else. It's not an essentialist principle. Mm-hmm. So what are the trade-offs you're willing to make? And part of the mindset process that I work on with clients initially, it goes mindset, resilience, and storytelling in my process, is figuring out what are the filters in order to prioritize things in your business, in your life. So once you have filters, you can say, this is 70, 80%, 90% on target with my values or my goals. And then once you have those filters, it's okay to say no to other things, but you can't just say no as a leader of a company with 30,000 employees. You have to create processes to create efficiencies, sometimes delegate more than you're comfortable with. But if you make those trade-offs, you put those systems in place, it becomes easier not only to execute, but to not stress about it. So I always tell people, if you're focused on something, I work in 90-day sprints with my clients. Mm-hmm. If in 90 days from now, this thing is no longer important, that's okay, because you don't have to worry about the fact that you maybe should think about it. Now you know you don't have to think about it. So whether you succeed at your initiative or failure initiative, if it's targeted towards this goal of having a better culture, being more on the ground, you create those filters, you prioritize them, and then you execute and you let everybody else know it's okay that other things are falling by the wayside because they're not essential or not critical. And they're just not what we need to focus on right now. And if change happens, like we talked about earlier, then you adapt, and you know you're going to adapt because you're going to put those same systems in place you have now for goal A or priority A, and just change them to priorities B and C. But your team's still going to function. People aren't going to freak out.
Hmm. It sounds like helping them really understand that. I mean, what we think now is important or part of the future isn't necessarily true. We try it out, see what happens, and if it's not part of the future, it's okay, right?
Yeah, and that comes back to the martial arts, the Tony Bauer spear system I was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, you start projecting future events that haven't even happened yet or might not have a probability. If somebody turns around the corner and comes at you, do you picture yourself getting mugged? Well, you're already reacting in a fear loop to something that hasn't happened and might not happen. So mm-hmm. the same thing in corporate America. People see headlines, their phones blow up, whether it's things in the news or things in the industry, and they're reacting to hypothetical situations. Now, some things you need to give attention towards because, you know, they could have strategic consequences, but most stuff is noise. And if you say that's okay, going, or you have somebody to deal with that and then bring it to you when it reaches a certain level over your 90% filter, now it deserves attention from the C-suite. I mean, below that is why you have trusted lieutenants that you can delegate to. You know, mm-hmm. you need to start focusing only on these big strategic initiatives and learn to lead. You know, and trust your team. And part of that trust is making sure they're prioritizing things based on the filters and the value system and the mission that you lay out for them. Mm.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the beginning when Blake, what you mentioned, listening, right? Not taking the time to pause and really listen to what's going on. It's interesting. I've been researching for a book I'm writing on actually the neuroscience of foresight and strategic foresight. And one of the things that seems to be really interesting, I think relevant here, is how, you know, our brain wants to create narrative or story around things very quickly. And I think one of the key things as I look at the neuroscience is the longer we can pause and delay our storytelling, you know, or creating the full narrative around something that's happening right now, the better we are, right? The more we have the opportunity to look at alternatives and what could happen and different possibilities. What are your thoughts on that? How does storytelling, or even like waiting to tell a story or giving the story enough time to develop, relate to leadership?
It reminds me of, you know, when you're competing for something and, you know, you kind of always want to go last. It reminds me of like the show Last Comic Standing or something. Damon, maybe you produced that too.
I didn't produce that one, no.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you've had the chance to have everyone else go before you, you kind of have an idea of what your chances and, you know, what has been said, what has not been said. You really have time to collect your thoughts and think about the context of what you're saying. And so the idea of Last Comic Standing and being able to really wait and see what everyone else, or even the show Chopped, where, you know, if you had the chance to see what other people were be cooking and then you could serve yours. I mean, it's not to be competitive, but to take time is to really understand what has already been done, what has already been said, what needs to be said. I also think there's such power and beauty in just restraint, in thoughtfulness, and not being emotional, not talking or reacting out of emotion. And I mean, it's really simple for leaders or non-leaders to wait to respond to an email 24 hours if it upsets you. You know, to, if something is heavy, then to really think and be thoughtful about how you respond. I think with social media, you know, we were talking about the headlines you get on your phone. And I mean, communication is just, it's all the time. Like even myself, we thought it'd be a good idea to buy the Amazon Echo for all of the grandparents. And I think there's six of them. and then they can just call us on video and see my three-year-old anytime. But at the same time, you know, it's great, but you know, you don't always want to talk to your parents at 7:30 a.m. on a Sunday. I love you, mom and dad, but you know, or, you know, with Alexa Echo, you can just kind of drop in to someone's house. So we had to turn that off so people couldn't just like show up like, hey guys, I'm here. What's for breakfast? But the point is that, you know, we're all communicating all the time, and it can, you have to be able to turn it off. And I mean, I'm a big fan of meditation of, you know, if I hear my phone go off and it's on the other side of the room, or like, I won't even look at it. And my husband's always like, you know, your phone rang or your phone. And I'm like, I don't care, because I'm in control of my devices rather than them controlling me. And I mean, the longer I'm in this business, I work for myself. Like I see other people act out and they don't realize that their reputation is forever tarnished by one email they've sent. And I think it's so important to just be thoughtful. Just because you can respond right away or communicate quickly doesn't mean you should. And hopefully that will resonate with everybody listening who, I mean, no matter what job you're in now, it's like a lot of employees are expected to be on all the time. And I think that you have to say no to that and put up boundaries to protect yourself, but also protect the work that you're doing and your teams, because I think boundaries are healthy for everyone. So if you're sending emails at 4 a.m. or 2 a.m, what is that? How does that affect the culture? How does that make other people feel when they feel like, well, I guess I should interrupt my daughter's birthday to respond to this email because my boss responds to emails who doesn't have kids on a Saturday and I don't want to get fired. So it's not just about you. We have to think about our actions, our words, and be thoughtful and slow.
Damon, how about your thoughts on that? Like delaying the story or delaying the response?
Oh, well, the response thing I tell people, unless there's a fire that you need to put out, you know, something really going on in the company, that if you feel compelled to answer an email after 7 p.m., answer it, save it in your draft folder. And in the morning, you might have 10 drafts, but at 7 a.m. when you should be back in your office or whatever it is, fire them all off. And I do that constantly. I learned that from a boss years ago. Because if you train people that you're available any time of the day, then you are, unless that's part of your gig. You know, I have friends who are assistants to big global executives, even Hollywood producers, and they're getting paid an outrageous amount of money for what they do because they're 24/7, basically concierge people. But most people don't live that life. So yeah, save it as a draft, fire them all off when you wake up in the morning. Storytelling, however, it's a key part of what I do with clients. And I think it's incredibly important. And most people, unless you've been in Toastmasters or you, for some way you've worked in entertainment and told stories narratively, it's really hard for people to think in a narrative structure, but you don't read the newspaper anymore. I mean, I read the newspaper on the weekends. I read the FT and Wall Street Journal. I love it. But during the week, I'm looking at videos in the Wall Street Journal. I'm looking at memes. I'm looking at videos on Instagram TV. Like, you know, you need to be able to tell a story because that's what people are digesting their information. So the most important story you need to be able to tell is the one you tell yourself. So the first storytelling exercise I do with my clients is kind of their own personal professional hero's journey as to why they matter, what they suffered for, what's the unique treasure they have to offer the world, and whose lives are they going to better, their customers, their employees, you know, who are the stakeholders. And then once you believe that story, you then tell that story in different ways so that you gain advocacy from different groups. But storytelling is incredibly important. And I've, you know, over the last, 1998, so 22 years, been telling stories in narrative film, reality TV, written format. So I kind of have my own process now that's kind of a mashup of three-act structure and hero's journey and some other stuff. But yeah, it's incredibly important. I mean, people need to learn how to tell stories. And if that means that you make, it's a trade-off. Do you think it's important enough to trade something outside of your schedule for it? Then do it. But the more and more communication that you push out, people are going to expect in whatever format it is to be told a story. You know, why am I buying into this? Why am I caring about this? Why am I giving it my mind share or my attention where everything else around me, on my phone, on my computer, people in my ears, walking in my office, why do I need to hear what Tyler's saying right now? Oh, because I see how it affects me in part of this bigger story, whether it's my company or whatever it might be.
No, that's, I like the idea of storytelling and how that's playing out here in this dialogue. And it's interesting because when I think of the past when I was younger and what I thought the story of a leader was, and it was all about the, you know, the loudest or the strongest or the tallest, biggest person in the room, who had a idea, and either they made everybody kind of follow along or they brought everybody in, into that vision as well. And then they achieved the goal. But I'm curious, like how the story of what it means to be a leader is changing and what it looks like in the future. And curious to hear what you think about that, Blake.
You know, in my business, I've been doing the speaking thing for 4.5-5 years. And it's such a relief to meet people that you think are going to be so intimidating. And they're just normal people. Like I've worked with the CEO and chairman of Allstate Insurance a few times now. And like, he runs a billion-dollar company, but he's just this like nice guy and telling me about his daughter. It's just a relief to remember, like, we're all just humans. And actually, when you go in, I'm sure Damon has his own experiences, but you meet these very powerful people. They're many times not what you think they're going to be. Even when I go give speeches and let's say I'm really nervous, I look at the audience. Everybody's tired. Their shirts are rumpled. They're just like, God, just let me have my coffee. I mean, they just look groggy. Everybody just like, it kind of makes you less nervous because you realize, oh my God, we're all just human beings. And also I think that today what I'm seeing at least is that companies are trying to diversify who they hire. Like even as a speaker, people tell me, you know, we've never had a female keynote speaker, but half of our audience, they're women, and we're so excited to have a woman speaker. And my husband does the same job, and unfortunately he'll not be up for opportunities because he's not female. And I'm like, sorry, honey, this is good for me, not for you. But I think it's nice that the pendulum is kind of moving in the other direction of like, oh, well, there's all these people that have stories, that have leadership that we haven't given the chance. And I think that strength comes from suffering, from learning what you're made of, and resilience, and learning to get back up. And I think people who aren't always given opportunities, who've had to work harder because they weren't just handed things when they were young, they actually have a lot of leadership skills and leadership qualities because they've had to dig deep and go through things themselves. So I think that it's an exciting time in the business world because now it's sort of unspoken, like, well, yeah, we should have more diversity. We should have more women. You don't have to look a certain way or act a certain way to be a leader. It's not about what you look like or what you say even. It's about what you do and how you treat people.
And Damon, what are your thoughts on that same kind of question around what's the story of the leader of the future?
Yeah, it's funny because I know Blake's going to love this, but the number one comment I always got from Undercover Boss, people said, oh my God, they're all so normal. They're just people. I'm like, yeah, they have, you know, kids that go through horrible stuff and they get divorced and the bad stuff happens, but they happen to be running a big company. It's funny, the most popular blog post I've written in the last 3 years was 2 weeks ago, and it was called "You Are Going to Suffer, Be Grateful for It." And it's all about the notion of growth through suffering, as Blake just talked about. But you have to, unless you go down and, you know, like there are no diamonds floating on top of a lake, right? You know, I mean, you need to go and really put in the work and suffer for whatever treasure you're going to find. But to your question, I think the key qualities, the two main ones for leaders of the future, one is to be able to experience and show empathy for whoever it is that you're interacting with, whether it's your customers, your employees. Empathy is a big one because now in today's world, customers almost demand it. You know, like they want to know that a brand understands and cares about them before they go interact with it. I actually had a brand do something that was so off core value message for me. And I had bought their products every month since I was 16 years old. And I literally, the moment that this happened, before I got home, I pulled over, walked into a store, bought their competitor, came home and threw it out and wrote them a really harsh email. because I felt like you don't empathize with your customer. You don't know anything about me, which you think you do. So empathy is one. The second one is having a viewpoint, very specific viewpoint, and supporting it with data. That goes back to storytelling. But why do you matter? Why do you matter in your industry? Why do you matter to your customers? And then supporting it with facts, not just warm, fuzzy, feel-good stuff, but, you know, data points that when you put them into a narrative, they're going to stick and they're going to remember them. So empathy, a perspective that is very specific, and supporting it with data and good storytelling abilities.
Very good. Great. Well, I think I'd like to wrap up here. And how I end the episode is ask each guest to share one word that they want to leave, kind of this idea of the future leader or the future intelligent leader. So I'll start with Blake. What's one word you want to leave?
But I just told you this whole thing about how going last and waiting, and I could see what Damon shared and I could think of a better word. No, I will say self-awareness. Mm-hmm. I think that it's hard right now. I mean, out there, just there's so much stress and panic, even in hysteria in the news. You know, life just seems to be getting faster and faster. So self-awareness, like slowing down, knowing who you are, what you need, not letting the world dictate your behavior, but being strong enough to say, well, this is what I need. And if this doesn't work for you, then that's fine. Like whatever that might mean for you, but just being willing to know yourself, to know your limits as well. Like for me, this is a big thing for me because I mean, being a speaker is a challenging job, even with travel. I have a 3-year-old, I'm pregnant, like my husband's an entrepreneur. I mean, there's just like a lot going on. Without mindfulness and self-awareness, I wouldn't be able to do this job. So I spend a lot of time like meditating, exercising. I write in a journal. I mean, I do tons of things that you wouldn't think like a business person should do, but lots of self-care just to figure out what I need from the world so I can give more to the world. And I think it takes guts, especially if you work in a big corporation, sometimes to ask for that. But you know, with leaders that just glow, that attract others to them, they don't seem to care about what's happening outside of themselves. I mean, they care, but they're also really in tune with themselves. They have confidence. They know themselves, and they have more to give to others because they're not living their life according to what the world is telling them to do, but rather what they know is best for them. And then in turn, they have much to give to those around them. So I would say self-awareness.
Great. And Damon?
I'm going to co-opt half of her answer and say self-validation, which is something I talk about a lot with the clients and when I speak publicly. You know, Stephen Pressfield, one of my favorite authors, wrote a great book called Turning Pro, outlining the differences between being an amateur and being a professional. And one of the big things is amateurs crave approval, professionals self-validate. But yes, we all need approval from stakeholders, and we all crave some sort of, you know, public validation from our peers. But mainly, you need the ability to self-validate. You need to know that you're working on the right things at the right time because you've done the work that we talked about earlier in creating those filters, that process, that mindset. And yeah, I mean, that's basically it. If you walk out into the world every day, there are a million different sensory overloads where people are craving validation, you know, in the press, like my LinkedIn post, follow this, do that, approve this initiative. But you need to be able to self-validate in order to go forward and know that with the confidence that you're working on what you should be. And it goes all the way back to the beginning of the conversation when Blake was talking about people like Jeff Bezos who don't care whether you think they're doing the right thing or not. Like, they have a vision and they're executing it. It doesn't mean they're not going to be flexible and pliable and pivot when they need to, but the bigger strategic vision is never going to change. They have a thesis about how the world is going to be 10, 20, 30 years from now. And they're going to act in service of that thesis. And they do that throughout their days and years by self-validating. They don't crave validation from anybody.
Really like that. So thank you both, Blake and Damon, for being in the episode today. I really appreciate your insights and wisdom.
Thank you. This was great.
Thank you, Tyler. It was fun.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.